This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll get more on the background of the man who was charged with stabbing a police officer at Flint's airport. Social media might be trying to entice you with ads, but really, they don't want to know you.
They're not trying to understand me in terms of ethnicity in order to really get my heritage. What they're trying to do is sell me a product.
Want to fix healthcare? Get a diverse group together.
People from all walks of life, young, old, professionals, in and outside of healthcare, come together to come up with new solutions for sometimes pretty old problems in healthcare.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe says Ford is breaking rules.
But they're saying, you know what, we're running this company for the shareholders first, and if we don't, we're going to continue to get pounded in the markets.
But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up this hour, how algorithms shape our lives online.
For example, I'm Danish, but they think I'm Hispanic. And they think I'm Hispanic only because I like tango music on Facebook.
But first, yesterday, a man with a 12-inch knife stabbed a police officer at the Flint airport. He allegedly shouted out in Arabic, "God is great." The FBI says it's investigating the attack as an act of terror. The police officer, bleeding from the neck, fought with his attacker until other officers could restrain him. The officer, Lieutenant Jeff Neville, was treated and he will survive. The man arrested is 50-year-old Amor Fatui. He's from Canada. To learn more about the alleged attacker, we're joined by Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter at the CBC in Montreal. So, Steve, what can you tell us?
We know that he lives in a neighborhood in Montreal that's sometimes referred to as Little Maghreb. So there are a lot of mosques. There are a lot of North African immigrants that live in those neighborhoods. He lives in an apartment with his wife and three children. We know at this hour there are Royal Canadian Mounted Police and Montreal Police at that apartment, but they say they're just there to assist the FBI, which is leading this investigation. They haven't even told us yet if they've searched inside the apartment. And it's also not clear where Amor Fatui's wife and his three children are right now. We've spoken to his landlord and neighbors, and they basically say, as far as they knew, he was a quiet family man, that they're surprised that he would be accused of something like this. And we also obtained a copy of his resume, so we're learning a little bit more about his work background. He had worked in the past as a security guard. Last year, he obtained his license as a commercial truck driver, but it wasn't clear if he had worked doing that yet or not. His resume also says that he had something called a FAST card, which allows truck drivers, they can apply for that. And on both sides of the border, they can go through expedited lanes to get across more quickly. To get one of those cards, you do have to go through a rigorous background check, and you're not supposed to have a criminal record. We've run his name. He doesn't have a criminal record in Canada, as far as we know. We also have some information from the court appearance that he made yesterday. And apparently at that court appearance, he said he understands English, but mostly speaks French. So there was a bit of comprehension problem there. He says he was born in Tunisia, has double Tunisian-Canadian citizenship, that he came to Canada 10 years ago. And he also said in that he did say that he works as a truck driver, but that he hadn't worked for 2 weeks. So it looks like he didn't use that FAST card or use a truck to cross the border, although we don't know that for sure. But I think we could surmise that if he's not working.
So you've talked to his landlord, you've talked to his neighbors. Nobody saw any kind of indication that he was very angry at the U.S. and wanted to lash out.
None whatsoever. We check social media as well. He has almost no social media profile. He is on Facebook, but I had three posts like 2 years ago and nothing to suggest any kind of radicalism. We know the FBI said yesterday they don't have a sense that he is connected to any known terrorist group or anything. We have seen in Canada before, in Quebec, these kind of quote-unquote lone wolf attackers. There was a guy in a town about an hour from Montreal, Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, who a couple of years ago ran over with his car two soldiers and killed one of them. And he was just somebody who had, from Quebec, born in Quebec, who had converted to Islam. There was evidence that he had looked at jihadist websites and stuff, but basically he didn't have any connection with any terrorist group. We've seen other cases like that here as well in Quebec and in Montreal.
That is Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter for the CBC in Montreal. Steve, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Lester.
Ford Motor Company is breaking some rules. That's a statement that leads off today's column from Daniel Howes of the Detroit News. Daniel, you write that it's widely accepted in the global auto business, build where you sell, and Ford's going to violate that practice. What's happening?
Well, they've announced for the third time, which is very unique, their plans for the next generation Ford Focus compact car. Initially, it was going to leave Michigan, and it was going to be assembled in a brand new plant to be built in Mexico. They decided against that and moved it to an existing plant in Mexico. And now they've, for the third time, changed their mind and are going to produce it in China for sale in North America, which has really never been done before for an established model by a Detroit automaker. A lot of your listeners may know that there's a new Buick midsize SUV called the Envision, which the UAW calls the Invasion, that is assembled in China and brought into the United States. But it was a new model and a new size within their range of SUVs. I think this, taking an existing model that's really been around for, probably close to 20 years, and sourcing out of China is a new move, and I think it's going to be the beginning of some other bolder moves by Ford.
Well, let's go further into that in a second. But the Focus is currently being built in Wayne, Michigan. Mm-hmm. What happens to that auto plant and those jobs?
Well, those jobs will remain intact, and that's a very important point. Ford has said this. The Detroit News for the last 2 years have been reporting about what's going to happen to Michigan Assembly in Wayne. They're going to be building a Ford Ranger. They're going to be bringing the Ranger back to the United States. It had been here for a long time, as a lot of your listeners know, and then they killed it in the U.S. with the assumption that the F-150 F-Series trucks, the range of them could be sufficient for the truck market. I think they've realized that General Motors, in reviving the midsize truck, probably was doing the right thing.
So yeah, Ford, the little Colorado looks pretty nice.
Yeah, exactly. So they're bringing that back, the Ranger, and they'll start producing that, I believe, later next year, 2018. And then they're reviving the old name that a lot of your listeners know is the Bronco. Not exactly sure what that thing's going to look like, but it's going to be an SUV. They're going to be building that there in Wayne in 2020. So I think what you see here is, obviously, an admission, the car market, and this, particularly the small car market, is withering, and the profitability of building those vehicles in the United States is not what it needs to be, particularly when you're building fewer of them, so you don't get as big of economies of scale. At the same time, you're seeing them reinvest in trucks and SUVs because that's where the margins are, and I think they're making a bet, as are General Motors and FCA, among others, that over the longer term, oil prices are likely to stay lower than they are high. And we're having this conversation as we go into the summer driving season, and gas prices are collapsing right now. And usually it's the other way around, that as you approach July 4th, prices continue to tick up. That's not happening. There's a glut of oil in the market, and the United States has become one of the largest energy producers in the world, which is kind of an offset to the volatility in the Middle East.
Now, as you mentioned, kind of a net zero gain in jobs, no loss, mm-hmm. No gain. But how does moving a production facility to China affect the relationship between Ford and its union workers?
I think any time, China is a red letter word, I think, in the auto industry in a lot of ways, particularly when it comes to union relationships with the unions. I think the fact that the UAW is relatively quiet about this is indicative of the fact that they know that really what's happening here is an attempt to maximize profitability and to site in the United States plants that are going to be building more volume. And those two things put together for a more sophisticated understanding of the industry, and which they do have in Solidarity House, leads to more profitability, which it benefits the workers. Because remember, their profit sharing checks are directly attributable and directly tied to the profitability of, in North America. And the more money they make as a company here, regardless of what they're selling, but let's assume for a second that they're selling more and more trucks and SUVs, which they are, the more money those workers are going to take home in profit-sharing checks every year.
You're right, it's still early days for Ford's CEO, Jim Hackett. What does moving Focus production to China and the other changes signal as far as the direction Hackett wants to take the company?
Well, one, I think, is it signals that he's going to start making some tough calls. I mean, we've been watching, and I've been writing about and talking on your air about what General Motors has been doing in places like Russia. They've left Russia. They sold Opel after, 90 years of owning it, essentially exiting all of the European market, which is incredible to me. But it's because they've done a cold, hard analysis, and they basically say, we don't think we're going to make any real money. It's going to have huge demands of capital, and we're going to be a bit player, 5, 6, 7% in a market where the biggest player is closer to 20%. So we're going to get out, and we're going to show the courage to do that. I think you're going to see more of that with Ford. I think this move going to China, amid the fact, we haven't talked about it, but you've got a president of the United States who's talking about build America, buy America, invest in America, and is not afraid to use his bully pulpit to beat somebody about the head and shoulders metaphorically. But they're saying, you know what, we're running this company for the shareholders first. And if we don't, we're going to continue to get pounded in the markets. So I think they're going to do more of that. I think you're going to see potentially a decision on India. I wouldn't be surprised to see Ford say we're going to exit the Indian market, which, by the way, General Motors has already done. Particularly ironic because it's one of the fastest growing major markets in the world. And some people believe that it could be the third largest single market in not too distant future. So you may have a situation where the biggest American players say, you know what, we don't think we can play there, or we're going to make enough money there to be there, and so we're going to cede it to other people.
Daniel Hiles is business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular right here on Stateside. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Next Idea, encouraging creative thinking around solving health problems.
If you put five physicians in a room and ask them to come up with new solutions to old healthcare problems, they will come up with some solutions. But if you put an automotive engineer and a social worker and a ballerina in a room and you give them good mentors, it might blow your mind what they can come up with.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. You've heard that advertisers are keeping track of every online site you visit. They keep track of the data to try to determine what you're likely to buy. Well, that online data collection is just the beginning. John Chaney Lippold is an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan. He's written a book titled We Are Data: Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Let's start with the simple stuff. I hear friends or I see comments online that if Facebook is trying to determine who I am, it's missing by a mile, judging from the things that pop up as things I might buy or find interesting. How well can they figure out who I really am?
I think there's two ways we can answer that. The first way is they will have no idea who you are, because who you are is a special spiritual thing that is contingent on, you know, what you believe. But then there's also the ways that they can interpret you based on extant categories. So Facebook, for example, they try to figure out your ethnicity through what they call ethnic affinity, that it's not necessarily based on who you might be or your history of your family, but rather what kind of things do you like on Facebook, who are you friends with on Facebook, maybe what your last name is. And through that, they assign something. For example, I'm Danish, but they think I'm Hispanic, and they think I'm Hispanic only because I like tango music on Facebook.
So how close does the digital self come to the real self in most cases?
In a sense, I think that we're talking about two different things, and so it gets close enough, but the idea is that they're not trying to understand me in terms of ethnicity in order to really get my heritage. What they're trying to do is sell me a product,
right,
or they're trying to sell me to a consumer commercial firm. So in that way, they're actually very effective if they're trying to sell me tango music, but they're also really ineffective if they're trying to talk to me about, you know, discrimination that Hispanics have in the U.S. But they're always trying to do the former instead of the latter.
So let's talk a little more about the commercial perspective. What's the harm in a retailer learning more about me? I mean, if they can help me find the things I want in my life, that's okay, right?
So in a very kind of like regular sense, there's nothing necessarily wrong. What happens is when there's an asymmetry of information between the consumer and the firm, then we get into a little bit of trouble. For example, 2014, Orbitz.com would actually take prices for planes and hotels and front load more expensive planes and hotels if you had a Mac browser, a Mac computer system, or maybe even a screen that was larger than normal.
Wow, is that even legal?
It's totally legal based on what we call dynamic pricing, but normally we always do this. Like if you see a person with a really nice suit come into a store, you might say, oh, this person can pay a little bit more, and you might push them towards more expensive jewelry or suits. But instead, on the digital, in the digital world, you can be very particular and not just show them a side of the store, but you can show them a particular product with a particular price.
Hmm. Now, I use a smartphone, I use the computer, I use a work computer. As a reporter, I visit a ton of sites that otherwise I wouldn't be visiting. Are they gathering all of that data from these different devices and these different motivations, that is personal versus professional, and saying this is who he is?
Yeah, and not just one person, but like several hundred different companies are taking all of this data. Some of them are selling some of the data to others. And so it's this almost cesspool of data that then takes, yeah, your cell phone location, but also who you're around. So the fact that my cell phone is now near your cell phone means we're kind of connected in a datafied way. And so it takes also the ability to connect your personal computer to your professional computer based on the fact that you might have similar behaviors on both, or you might use a similar account on both. And so it's able to tether, yeah, a large mass of seemingly disparate information together into then a datafied profile that assumes things like gender, class, or age.
We mentioned the data shared. I'm just wondering, who are the big keepers of all that data?
The big ones that we can normally think of are the Facebooks and the Googles. They're smaller companies who do marketing that I talk about. They're called like Audience Science or Quantcast, people or firms you would never actually hear about. But increasingly, we have ISPs getting in the game. The recent Trump administration rolled back FCC regulations and said ISPs couldn't involve in this $83 billion industry, but now they're giving carte blanche to take 100% of your traffic that comes from you and try to profile you accordingly.
One of the things I've always wondered, does Facebook sell this data, or do they use it and say it's proprietary so that we can sell bigger ads?
Facebook, as a monopoly or kind of monolithic platform, they're reluctant to sell their data, and they've actually explicitly said they wouldn't, but that doesn't really mean anything. They could change their mind later. But they say they won't sell it to outside companies, but what they can do is they can sell portals to their consumers. And so what they do is they profile their consumers and say, if you want access to this portal, you can pay us a little bit of money and we will give you access. But that's after the data's been processed and often after you've given an age or an ethnicity through their pattern assessments.
You indicate in the book that it's not just corporate America, but law enforcement is also making some assumptions about you based on the same data. What are they doing with that information?
So that is very interesting because in the example of my book, the Chicago Police Department takes block data from streets and tries to figure out what is high crime and what is low crime. So a block might be high crime at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then the next day it might be low crime at 9 a.m. The idea, though, is that this data isn't necessarily true or effective. So what happens is there's the Chicago Police Department created this list of about 400 people that, based on their social media connections or based on the contacts that they have in their phone, would label them at risk from the Chicago Police Department. This isn't because they're actually at risk of committing a crime, but just their social networks suggest they're more likely to be connected to criminals than not.
So you're guilty by association.
Precisely that.
Wow. You also indicate the data are used to attempt to determine your race, your gender, your sexual identity, your age, whether you're a foreigner. How can that be used when it's so unreliable, as we were talking earlier? Because, you know, you are not who they think you are.
Yeah, I think with the idea of being a foreigner is very compelling because the NSA in 2013, when the PRISM documents came out from the Snowden leaks, we really had to reconsider how it is that citizenship is allocated online, because when you go online, you just have an IP address. You just have a MAC address of your hardware and your computer. So the NSA, without kind of admitting that they did this because it was all in private, they reformed what it meant to be a citizen. And so instead of being a citizen because they have a passport or their birth certificate, you're a citizen if your data is seen to be 51% confidently citizen, and thus you're a foreigner if you're seen to be 51% confidently foreign.
So let's say I'm a United States citizen, and in fact, I'm a native. I was born here. But I have a lot of relatives who speak Spanish, and I text them in Spanish back and forth. I have some relatives back in the old country, and I communicate with them. I would be considered a foreigner.
Most definitely. The ideas that the NSA uses to draw this are exactly what you said. If you speak any languages other than English, if you have media connections or communication connections to people outside the U.S., or even if you go visit your family in the old country, if you draw an IP address from a place outside the borders of the United States, that is a datafied element that suggests confidence in your foreignness.
Let's talk about if I can figure out what they're saying about me, because I can file a Freedom of Information Act and I can obtain the file the FBI might have on me. Can I obtain the data law enforcement is using to build a profile of me?
In the case of the CPD, the Chicago Police Department, it's likely that you could get a FOIA request for that. But for something like the NSA, that is, every NSA FOIA request has more or less been denied. But also, a lot of this stuff is changing every day. So my citizenship, when I'm talking to friends in the U.S., might be very high citizenship of the U.S. But then the next day, if I'm talking to friends outside, or maybe if I'm doing a vacation or going on vacation and doing research out of the country, that would then suggest I'm foreigner. So it doesn't really matter necessarily. This dossier is at that moment of when they're trying to make that an assessment. What is your data saying?
This seems so George Orwell, 1984, Big Brother really is watching you. What can we do to preserve any shred of privacy?
So I think that the idea of privacy is, for me, compelling because we shouldn't give it up. I think privacy is very important, but in the increasing saturation of media into our lives, it's difficult to find the refuge of like a 19th century privacy where you can just close the door and be by yourself. Rather, I think we should take the idea of U.S. privacy law, which is the right to be let alone, and think about it in a subjective sense of like, how am I at this moment being let alone, or am I being controlled? And so in the case of these data veiling companies or the companies trying to algorithmically assess you, they are trying to get a little bit more money out of you, or they're trying to direct you just one way or the other. And the way they do it is through patterns. And so if you don't fit the pattern, it's likely that you have a little bit more freedom, a little bit more ability to be let alone. And so a lot of the things in the book I talk about are actually not trying to hide yourself from surveillance, but saying if the logic is that you have to have a pattern to make you're legible to the algorithmic system, what they should do is just have a bunch of random queries that completely confuse the algorithms that try to find signal in the noise. Because if you produce enough noise in the system, that might then completely upend the potential signal.
Oh, as a reporter, I might be already doing
that's
that.
That's potentially the case, yeah.
All right, that's John Chaney Lippold. He's the author of the book, We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Epiphanies.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
Usually when we hear the word hacking, we think of someone breaking in, like hacking into your computer. But there's a constructive, positive spin on the word hack. Case in point, the A2 health hacks happening this weekend. And what's come out of this could wind up impacting healthcare. Cynthia Canty recently spoke to Diane Buis. She's the co-founder of Ann Arbor Health Hacks and the director of innovation programs at the Inovo Group.
What happens at the A2 Health Hacks?
It's a weekend-long exercise, and people from all walks of life, young, old professionals in and outside of healthcare, come together to come up with new solutions for sometimes pretty old problems in healthcare.
How does this happen?
So we generally just start with breakfast and keynotes to inspire you. Imagine you're an automotive engineer and you know nothing about healthcare, but you hear that healthcare is awesome and you should get into healthcare because it's a growing sector. How do you know what the problems are and how do you get into healthcare? Well, you try it out for a weekend. And then everybody in the room, and usually it's about a third of the people in the room, get an opportunity to get up and pitch for 30 seconds, and we're tight on those 30 seconds, mm-hmm. the problem they'd like to work on. And after that, you have a mix and mingle period. So if you sit there and you listen to me pitch my problem and the next person pitching their problem, you can say, you know, number 1 and 13 and 47, those are problems I'm interested in. Let me talk to that person. Let me see if we jive. And so it's almost like speed dating. You talk to a couple of people, and in that context, you decide maybe the personalities don't jive or maybe we have different approaches. Let me talk to the next group. And so by noon, teams will will have formed around their skills and problems they're interested in. And between noon and noon, 24 hours, you have the time to generate a prototype of whatever it is you want to make. Hmm. And that can be a physical prototype, that can be a piece of code. Whatever you want to show the judges at noon the next day is your prototype for a new solution in healthcare.
And what's at stake? What do people get for their efforts?
Our sponsors have allowed for us to have great prizes. And so first and second prize are automatic entry into the Ann Arbor Spark Bootcamp. That is a 6-week program, $1,500 value to get your company off the ground. As an organization, Ann Arbor Health Hacks is about healthcare innovation and spawning new healthcare startups here in our community. And so aligned with that mission is, all right, we help you find that idea, find the teammates, and then start that company. Now, not everybody starts a company. You may go back to your day job on Monday morning, and that's perfectly fine. But if you do start a company, the first prize and second prize, the entry into the boot camp will get you there. And our third prize is with the Searchlight. It's a customer discovery journey. There as well, it is to help you get your company off the ground, to get your prototype to the next stage.
This isn't the first year you've done this.
That's right.
What kinds of ideas and problems have people come up with? Give us a for instance idea that led to what?
So the cool thing is, if you get a bunch of really smart and dedicated people in a room, it may amaze you what they can do in 24 hours. So I think what's nice to see is the diversity. I'll start with a third prize. That was a physical device. A physical device that basically positions the bones of your arm in 3D space. And that can help with physical therapy. Mm-hmm. Think of it as two Fitbits, one on your wrist and one closer to your shoulder. And those two devices together will position every bone in your arm in 3D space. And so you may not have to go to your physical therapist. Your physical therapist from afar can tell you, you're not stretching enough. Go a little bit farther. I know exactly where your arm is. So that's a prototype of a physical device.
And wouldn't that be great for someone who's perhaps in a rural area?
Exactly. Yeah. So that is really overcoming a problem. Another example is our first prize winners, disease detectives. What they made was a prototype of self-reporting for children for respiratory symptoms. Now, that sounds complicated, but if I tell you, if you have a 4 or 5-year-old and for a clinical research study, we want to know exactly what their symptoms are, it's really hard for a mom to stay super on top of how much is my child wheezing or coughing. If I give the child a cell phone with a game on it and let the child play, and during the game, it's being asked some questions as in, hey, are you wheezing? Are you coughing? How much? That is self-reporting, which is way better than somebody else reporting your symptoms. So that's also a solution to an existing problem where the workarounds are just suboptimal. So it can be very diverse. And I want to stress that the types of opportunities we're looking for apply to the developing world as well as the developed world. And so the types of solutions can be very, very different. Something low tech that works in a developing country may not apply here, but may really change lives.
What have you seen as Ann Arbor, as A2 Health Hacks has happened, about what is it about getting people together like this that you think is important in terms of solving healthcare problems?
I think complex problems are not easy to solve. That's why they're complex. And practically, they take more than one skill set. And so I often joke, if you put 5 physicians in a room and ask them to come up with new solutions to old healthcare problems, they will come up with some solutions. But if you put an automotive engineer and a social worker and a ballerina in a room and you give them good mentors, it might blow your mind what they can come up with. Or not. It's entirely possible that at the end of the weekend you decide that you found that there is no there there. But sometimes there is a there there, and it's amazing. And it is this intersection of the 20-year-old college student and the 65-year-old retired finance guy that really makes a difference. It is at the intersection of people with different expertise and different knowledge that you can find great things.
Now, clearly this event is really unique. Is it the only one in Michigan of its type?
Not at all. Actually, hackathons and healthcare hackathons exist all over the country. And there is another group in Michigan that does this once a year as well. And so we're just trying to enrich the ecosystem. They're called Hacking Health, and they have a Windsor, Detroit chapter. And they do the same thing practically once a year as well.
And what kind of communities would be best suited? If somebody's listening to us talking, going, you know what, we ought to do that. What does it take?
I think it takes a community where there are smart and dedicated people. Often what helps is an entrepreneurial community, so a community where there are already startup companies. It helps to have IT talent, engineering talent, and medical talent. So if you have a health system, if you have a startup community, if you have some IT and engineering talent, if you think about it, that's Michigan. That's that's a lot of our communities. We truly believe that it is at the intersection of a university and the private sector that cool things happen.
Now, who can participate and are there still openings?
So we did just close registration, and so you cannot participate this year. Practically, we still encourage people who want to be a mentor over the weekend. So that's seasoned professionals in IT, health, or engineering to help our participants over that entire 24-hour period. So we're no longer looking for participants. However, we're always looking for people who want to get involved for next year. That is, volunteers, people who want to grow our community. We definitely want participants for next year, and we want mentors for this year and next year. So contact us by all means. The website is a2healthhacks.org.
And that is the number two. So a2healthhacks.org. Diane Buies, thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea, and good luck with the A2 Health Hacks this weekend.
Thank you very much for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up later, industry is quickly developing driverless cars, but we really don't have any set of standards for automated vehicles.
And almost in the standards arena, it's almost like the Wild West at the moment.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. This fall, two completely driverless shuttles will start running on the University of Michigan's campus. Researchers will be focusing on safety, but it's also a chance to see how people interact with driverless vehicles. Stateside's Tyler Scott got to ride in one of the shuttles at M-City, which is the university's testing ground for driverless and connected cars, and he has this audio postcard for us.
About to ride the Navia Arma. Okay. So this is one of the driverless vehicles that'll be shuttling Michigan students around campus this fall. It looks like a really small bus, but not having a driver's seat or a steering wheel frees up a lot of space. Surprisingly, like 15 people fit in here fine.
How did we all squeeze in here?
I don't know.
Safety is always our first priority here.
Carrie Morton is the assistant director of M-City. She's kind of leading us on the tour. All of us are just kind of hanging around talking, and the bus is driving along its pre-programmed route.
The shuttles operate in a very conservative manner so that if they even think they detect a person or a pedestrian, they're going to stop.
One morning early when I was unfortunately here by myself, it stopped for a fawn in the spring.
Or Canadian geese.
Or Canadian geese.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll do it.
That's Greg McGuire. He's the lab director at M-City. You can hear the air conditioning in the background, but the actual car is pretty quiet. In addition to being fully autonomous, it's electric too.
You can see signs that say powerful braking. That's because whenever the vehicle detects any kind of obstacle, it stops very abruptly.
She's not kidding. It's not long before we're talking and suddenly the car comes to a total stop, kind of shakes us all, and we're pretty surprised there's not really any warning.
Encountered a potential obstacle.
Yeah.
And so you can see why the safety handles are there.
We get going again, and Carrie's telling us that with these shuttles on campus this fall, researchers will get pretty much their first chance to study something they can't at a test track. They've attached cameras to the vehicles to study how people interact with the technology and whether they accept seeing driverless cars out on the road.
I think there are more questions than answers, and we found the best way to answer those questions are to learn by doing. So doing work here in M-City, then on campus, Ann Arbor, it's beyond the technology itself. It's more about the consumer acceptance, giving us a glimpse sort of into the future.
Eventually, it's time to head back. Greg, the M-City lab director, picks up what looks just like a video game controller. It's like the manual override. He can pick it up and steer the whole vehicle with the joystick.
We're gonna cheat, since this vehicle is programmed for a bus route. We want to get back on the route without having to go all the way around.
It's not long, and we're back to the parking lot. This vehicle has a lot of glass on it, and the sunlight shines right through, and it can get pretty sticky.
Okay.
Thank you all very much. In the cool breeze. You can tell that humans put out quite a bit of heat energy once we are crammed in here.
Glass in this design.
Woo! It's hot. The whole concept of driverless cars out on the roads is kind of scary, but this one only goes about 10 miles an hour. And Carrie points out that getting rid of some of those anxieties about driverless cars is the whole reason for doing the research.
There's always going to be a hesitation with the unknown. And so coming together with a variety of sectors, not just the auto industry, but also the insurance industry, the telecom industry, the infrastructure providers, we can learn those lessons together so we can accelerate our innovation by gaining confidence of insights into the future.
For Stateside, I'm Tyler Scott.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. We keep hearing about the technological advances that are making the dream of self-driving cars a reality. But along with developing the technology, there must be guaranteed safety. And that comes through setting standards for connected and automated vehicles. This month, the American Center for Mobility at Willow Run entered into formal agreements with the Institute of Transportation Engineers and the SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers International, to start creating those voluntary standards. We now turn to Andrew Smart. He's the Chief Technical Officer of the American Center for Mobility, and he spoke with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
When we talk about standards, exactly what are we talking about?
It's the foundation for the technology. If you look at anything that we have around us today, standards are all around us, whether it be whatever you want to power your phone with. There are some standards for that, even the wall socket. It's three-prong or two-prong, it's standards. And if you have that, everyone can manufacture goods. It's really just the essence of what we do, but people seem to take it very much for granted. What's happened in the last few years as regards automated vehicles is the generation of the intellectual property and the technology has been going absolute gangbusters. But people obviously are developing it for themselves and their own technology for their own vehicles. And because of that, they really haven't had, one, the time, or in another sense, maybe almost the inclination to develop the voluntary standards, because that may give other people a leg up.
Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of overcome that inherent desire to hang on to my intellectual property.
There's a balance in all these things, and this will plateau in the next 12 to 18 months, where people will find themselves, they've made certain announcements, this is this type of technology we're moving to, and so therefore people will become a little more open, because engineers, the challenge is if you get 250 of them in a room, one, to get them all to agree at the same time is a challenge in itself. But for all of them to almost give away the deepest secrets of what's going on won't be happening. So you've got to have a balance of where the technology is. And I think we're getting to that point.
And why is this the time, and maybe even past time, to start developing and having voluntary standards?
Well, we're really way behind. Normally, with any development work, standards soon follow. And then where appropriate, regulations follow that. But in this sense, standards process really hasn't kicked off in earnest.
So the big technological push has been going on.
Oh, absolutely. And that's way, way out in front. As we know, you can't pick up any newspaper or automotive journal without this kind of technology. And so now, vehicle safety. The last official figures, 35,092 lives were lost in 2015. 2016 went up 8% or so. We're probably up 8% or so again this year. That's just wrong. And so whatever can be done to reduce this is how we can make the push for the standard side as well. That's a key part of it too. So it all must come together.
So apart from the push for autonomous vehicles being, making life more convenient and I can do other things besides worrying about that line of cars ahead of me, you're saying we're absolutely talking about saving lives in this push.
Oh, absolutely. Over 100 a day. Yeah. It's almost become white noise now, which is disturbing to me. When, if you had that in terms of an aircraft a day went down with 100 people on board, that would be absolutely unacceptable. But here we are. And NHTSA are pushing as much as they can for certain regulation, working with industry. So there's a lot to be done.
So our transportation system that we have had since the beginning of the 20th century is starting to get threadbare. Looking ahead to the idea of mobility and autonomous vehicles, it's time for standards. So why are these three groups, the American Center for Mobility and the Institute of Transportation Engineers and SAE International, why are these the right ones to be creating these standards?
Well, we come at it from different directions. ITE is really looking at the transportation infrastructure. So when the vehicles are communicating with the infrastructure, that's required. Then when you look at the fundamental vehicles themselves, that's where SAE is required. And where ACM comes into this is we play very much a role as one to convene, but also to bring them together within the proving ground and safe proving environment to almost accelerate the deployment.
And it's neutral, so it isn't one car maker or one...
No.
So this is the idea that here you are. Here's the science. Here's the engineering. Okay, let's get everybody on the same page. So what's the process? You're basically creating something out of thin air, aren't you?
In a well, way, thank you very much.
You really are. When you think about this is all
I'll
so
patent
new.
That. The processes themselves, ITE and SAE have been doing this for many years in their own bespoke areas, but bringing them together and almost in the standards arena, it's almost like the Wild West at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because if you imagine, at the moment, your car can be communicating to your audio system. So you're playing through there. You're talking through it and you can hear it. It's hands-free technology. So your phone is interacting. But then your car can then be communicating in some new models, communicating with the infrastructure as well. But what you have is almost a fundamental disconnect. 30 years roughly to put together total infrastructure, about 30 months to develop a vehicle, and about 30 weeks to develop a smartphone.
Boy, that's a lot to have to try to put together into one unit, kind of in a sense, all these movable parts.
So if you then say, well, how many advancements or how many iPhones or... Yeah. The like we produced during the development period for a car, that would be many. And yet, when the engineers are developing and designing the vehicle, when it goes into job one, it's got to interact with the phone of the day. So going back to your question of standards, interoperability, it all must work together seamlessly, because that's a major frustration for the end users.
Now, how long, you've begun the process of developing these voluntary standards, how long do you think it'll take before that process is complete? He smiles ruefully.
It's a never-ending story. Yeah. It's where to start. You look at all the technologies at the moment. Where we're starting on this is then really looking at outcomes, because we want to look at it almost being technically agnostic. And if you do it that way, then no one needs to share their own intellectual property. But it's what happens as the overall outcome. You can go to YouTube and read many press articles of incidents with automated vehicles. There are certain incidents that are well documented. There's some that aren't, maybe during the development process that people find things out. So we want to get into a situation where people start to share these things. And once they do that in an open forum, then we can start talking, well, if that's the outcome, how can we develop standards to test to that? And if we can test to it, therefore we can validate it. So therefore, the vehicles are safe to go out onto the road.
And because there's zero room for error here. I mean, you're very aware of people's misgivings about autonomous vehicles. Start with, I don't want to be the one where they find out the system failed and I wind up going into the side of an abutment.
No, Control-Alt-Delete is not a function that you'll have in an automated vehicle, or the blue screen that you see on some things, or, you know, press it, you know, turn it off and turn it back on again and wait 10 to 15 seconds. That's not the option here. And because of that, it's foolproofing. It's then having all sorts of systems in place. And so that's where it's technically, it's very advanced. And when you have levels of artificial intelligence, that's another challenge you have. When you're trying to validate a product, you can validate a product in front of you, but if there's artificial intelligence, it learns.
And that's a process.
Exactly. And then rinse and repeat.
And then let's factor in the human factor. In fact, as you and I talk, the new report is out from the NTSB on that crash of the man who died driving the Tesla when it was on autopilot to hit a semi. And the NTSB has just released its report, and it found the driver ignored repeated warnings to put his hands on the wheel. And apparently, contrary to the reports we heard, he was not watching. The family lawyer insists he was not watching a video. But the NTSB report finds he ignored the warnings, put your hands on the wheel. So we've got that human factor. how do you, you can set all the standards in the world and then you put a human behind the wheel.
That is, the human is, well, human in the loop.
Human in the loop.
And if you have the human in the loop, it's all about the education. And clearly I can't go into the details of that, but it's all about education. And people, I'm finding at the moment, have a lot of faith in the technology. I'll give you one example. I was speaking to a young lady. I was asking her her vehicle, her driving style, etc., very interested. And she said, oh, yes, when the light in my door mirror goes out, I know it's safe to overtake. Hmm. And I stopped and I said, sorry, could you just repeat that? So if you sense of a bulb in that mirror goes off, and that's your absolute confidence without any other means to then step out into traffic. Oh, absolutely. Chills, you know, the hair's got up in the back of your neck and going, I said, madam, I would strongly advise you. You've been taught to look over your shoulder, use your mirror. That is only an aid.
So there's a lot of retraining that will have to happen as this technology is being developed, as the standards are being developed. So let's just freelance here. How long do you think it's going to take before we're not surprised by autonomous vehicles on the road, before they're commonplace?
I think people already have a vision of them, which again is concerning because they already have a vision in their mind of what they're going to be. If you look at the deployment and the announcements, you know, 2021, around that time, we'll have some deployments in some urban areas, almost on a fleet basis. Some people might even say you might be a little underwhelmed by it because absolutely safety critical. This is the first rollout of such vehicles in a fleet manner so they can be managed, ensure the deployment is working well. So that's the first phase. Then when you say, when will mainstream come on board? Probably about 5 or 6 years after that. Then we have 250, 260 million vehicles in the US. We sell 15 to 16 million a year. So I'll let your listeners do the mental arithmetic on that one to say how many years it will take just to turn over. But that's when everything is going to be automated. But people still like their 57 Corvettes and things like that. And then there still has to be the interoperability of cars talking to one another, cars that have no communication and some that have all. So when you look at when will it be fully mainstream, to me, towards the end of the 2020s, people will be far more comfortable with it. But then it's still a long, drawn-out process to get there. People's choice and people's education, again, to the technology and the faith.
You feel like a pioneer?
In some ways, yes. It really is, goes back to the safety aspect. It's a personal thing to me in terms of the saving of lives, the safety element to it and mobility. And when I hear the other stories, I just cringe and say, okay, we've got to do this sooner. And that's where it came to the standard side.
Andrew Smart is with the American Center for Mobility, where he's the chief technical officer. And I'm expecting to hear news pretty soon. Should we, by the end of the year or so, that out at the ACM, things are moving along? We're ready to put some vehicles on test tracks?
Yes, we are. The absolute focus at the moment, we call it the bringing the spirit of 42, everything that happened to Willow Run and what was done there in 18 months. And we're really trying to take that same spirit because everything that we're doing is accelerated. Working with the local township, Ypsilanti Township. So I've got to go through the same motions that everyone else, but how can we streamline it? How can we expedite the situation? Bringing the people on board with construction, it's a different site. You see things going up and you learn so much more from a site that's been around for 75 years. Oh, it's a learning experience in more ways than one I can tell you.
Andrew, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Pleasure.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There's so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we can't possibly know about all of it. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. So if you've got a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along by going to Stateside's page at michiganradio.org. Tomorrow, we talk with one of the Federal Reserve Regional Bank presidents. He's holding town halls. And the next one is in the UP.
A big part of my job is to represent our region when I go back to Washington, D.C., and then we set monetary policy for the nation. And so hearing directly from people who live in the UP is why I'm going there, and I hope people will come out to the town hall.
A conversation with the 9th District Federal Reserve Bank President Neil Kashkari on Stateside tomorrow. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.